Wednesday's lecture, where we looked at the Einstein action, but found that the the action, as usually happens with Lagrangian systems, has a total derivative in it, and so that integrates up to a boundary term. But unlike normal Lagrangian sort of methodology, this boundary term consisted of derivatives of the field that was being varied. And so I said, well, you know, that's a boundary term that you can't legitimately set to zero. And then we looked at the Euclidean Schwarzschild solution and commented that if we just used Einstein-Hilbert, then a whole load of solutions to the vacuum Einstein equations would all have the same action, which would be zero. So that didn't seem very helpful. So that's the clue that we need to think a little bit about boundaries. And of course, a boundary of a manifold is like one dimension less. So it's like a submanifold. So that kind of leads us to this thinking about submanifolds. But it's also actually quite interesting to think about submanifolds more generally, because we come across solutions in gravity that are approximately lower dimensional. So the obvious one, like the boundary, is a wall that's just has one extra dimension. So there are things called domain walls, but there are also more general manifolds of lower dimension. You can have strings, we can obviously have points, and if you're in higher dimension, you can have all sorts of different dimensionality, brains as they're called. So the brain comes from membrane. So what we'll just look at today is the mathematics of the submanifolds, and you know, maybe by the end we'll have solved our Euclidean action problem, but then I'll probably also talk a little bit about the physics of the submanifolds in next week, talking about some of these physical solutions that look lower dimensional and how they interact with gravity. So in other words, I guess what I'm asking you to visualize is some surface, some subset, which we call sigma, which is in itself a manifold. So in other words, it is covered by, you know, it's completely covered by some open sets, each of which have a mapping on them that takes you from that open set down to an underlying flat R to the D in this case. So here, sigma has dimension D. So that means sigma is a manifold. Even if you'd know nothing about M, you'd say, okay, so my sigma is a differential manifold. But then, on top, this sigma is also a subset of some bigger manifold M. And of course, M itself has charts which go down. And now I'm going to say that the dimension of my M is capital D. So you have this picture where sigma, you can either look at it just on its own as its own little manifold with sets of charts, local charts, taking it down to this underlying flat RD, or you could think about the points in sigma as being some subset of this bigger manifold M, and then they would be some mapping over into R to the D. So I haven't given myself enough space, let me make it bigger. So here, this would be my point, And then I would imagine that this would be like the subset of R to the D, which corresponded to sigma. So this would be like sigma. Well, the image of sigma in some local manifold chart. And then I'm saying, you know, this sort of imagining that there's this map, X mu sigma A. So we have these two ways of viewing sigma. And we would say, you know, if we wanted to put words to them, we would call this one here sort of intrinsic. In other words, you make no reference to anything else. And then over here, you might call this one extrinsic, which is saying you're thinking not just, I suppose it comes from the in and the x, you're thinking of it in terms of its surroundings as well. So what we're going to do is just use, sort of develop a way of describing the geometry of this sigma by kind of using this parallel here and thinking about, you know, what are the properties of these coordinate, this coordinate image of sigma. So first of all, just to be, I've already, I think I might have even said the word, but just to be clear, a definition. Goodness me. So the codimension of sigma in M is, if you like, the number of dimensions that are orthogonal, you know, if we use our metric intuition, though of course you don't need a metric to have a submanifold, but it's kind of like the number of orthogonal directions. And in fact, you can see this as by saying that there are N linearly independent vectors at any given point. You can look in the tangent space and you kind of can choose n directions such that they annihilate the internal coordinates. So I guess if I put that in components in the language, now, that requires a metric, what I've just written down, because I'm then using this intuition of orthogonal. But actually, these coordinate functions here, I can kind of view those, if you like, as sort of some, you know, R to the D is a subset of R to the big D, and therefore, you know, remember, vectors act on functions and give you numbers. But I've personally find this, given that we're dealing with gravity anyway, I think this is the easiest and most intuitive way of thinking about it, because it's saying that in your surface here, sigma, you imagine you have sort of coordinates, right? Say these sigma A, so say that's sigma 1 and sigma 2. And so here, this dx mu by d sigma a is like a tangent to one of these curves. And so a normal would be sort of sticking out, if you like, from the surface. So that is kind of the intuitive way for, I guess, for, you know, for gravitational people to think about it. So just to see Well, off again. Just to kind of spell it out, let's think of the sphere, which we define as a subset of R cubed. And so we define it by giving a constraint. And so here, our x mu are just the x, y, z coordinates. Our sigma a are going to be theta and phi. Those are the intrinsic coordinates on the sphere. And then we know that the surface can be represented by two angles. So we sketch, whenever we draw the two sphere, we're actually doing it as a submanifold of R cubed. That is how we always sketch the two sphere. And so our phi equals constant lines are our theta coordinate lines go from north pole to south pole, and our phi lines go around the sphere. So we put a chart. Now, the chart is not regular at each pole. We usually don't bother about that. But if it was an intrinsic manifold, we would have to just make the comment that at each pole, we go into local xy coordinates. So we know it's not, it's just a coordinate singularity. So here, our normal, sort of fairly obvious, it's d by dr, but if I have my Cartesian coordinates, I have to decompose d by dr in terms of d by dx and d by dy and d by dz, but this is all very straightforward. So from our knowledge of polars, we know that n acting on our intrinsic coordinates vanishes, but let me just be a bit annoying and say, because in this case we have so much intuition, we kind of see it obviously, but if we were to just follow what I've written there and say, you know, pretend we didn't know this was the first time we were seeing this surface, we would say, well, I know my xyz coordinates, I've got these new theta phi coordinates. I just want to make sure that the normal actually is normal. So this goes to so this is what my normal dotted with a tangent vector is. So if I look at the theta component, then my I've got to sort of sum the x dx by d theta plus y dy by d theta plus z dz by d theta. And you can sort of see that, so x you sort of see that the x and y parts cancel with the z part. And then similarly with the phi, you see that the x and y cancel out. So by sort of putting your nose to the floor and not trying to sort of think and just follow the rules, you see that, yes, that all works. And it all corresponds very nicely to our spherical polar coordinate system. So we're not in R cubed, we're in some curved four-dimensional Lorentzian manifold. Now, because we're only focusing on the surface, we've actually got a lot of freedom what we do off the surface. And I'm going to take ni mu nj mu equal to either plus or minus 1. Now, of course, this is no Einstein summation convention there over the I. It's just a notational thing. So in other words, I'm going to normalize. We've got a metric because we're doing GR, and I'm going to normalize my normal. So there are two things. If n is time-like, then this gives a sort of what we call the ADM formalism. And so I guess if you do some more quantum gravity type of modules, then you'll see this. And the reason is that you're sort of imagining slicing your manifold through with some constant time surfaces. And so this then gives a description of time evolution in GR. I think one of the things that we don't maybe stop to appreciate enough is the fact that GR is a theory of the manifold, you know, which is eternity. It's right from the beginning, right to the end. And it's the whole manifold. So it doesn't have a sort of, you know, our notion is we have initial conditions and we propagate them forward. So we want to know what's going to happen tomorrow or next week, right? We're very much stuck experiencing time in the moment. But GR isn't. GR is the whole lot. And that's why you get some funny stuff when you look at event horizons, because the definition of event horizon is from the four-dimensional manifold perspective. So here, that's sort of a way of breaking down GR into an evolution, which of course you need to do if you're interested, say, in black hole mergers. You've got to be able to do that. If n is space-like, dear me, so this would be an example of a space-like manifold, sub-manifold. So for example, I might have N1 and N2, two normals. So this would be an example of Ni space-like. And this would be a string world sheet, for example. So in other words, the submanifold is something that in and of itself is also Lorentzian. So sigma would be Lorentzian. Is that a hand going up there?
I was just going to ask, what does ADM stand for? I think you might have...
Oh, that's just, you'll see that. So it stands for the guys that developed it. And I may misspell them.
And what's the general formalism? It just has to do with... Oh!
You'll see because... Sorry?
No, it's not just the signature. What's the formalism?
It's a whole formalism of describing space-time as a set of space-like sheets evolving in time. Okay. And so in order to do that, you have to take your four-dimensional Einstein equations and kind of split them up into something that's happening on the surface and something that's happening with the evolution. So I'm going to focus on the right-hand side just because I'm going to, you know, keep it. I mean, you've got to make a choice, right? And I don't want to have this thing floating around all over the place because otherwise it just makes things, it confuses things. But the formalism that I'm developing won't depend on whether the normal is space-like or time-like. It's the same sort of formalism, you just maybe get a few minus signs. So what you'll see is how we break down the things that we've already been looking at, the connection, the curvature, into things that are parallel and things that are orthogonal. So that's really all this is about, okay? And so I'm going to say here, if you like, without loss of generality, I'm going to take my normals to be space-like. Okay, so now I'm going to do a few definitions. Because we have to be clear what we're dealing with. So we've already got the concept of codimension and the concept of normals. So we want to now just say, well, what is the metric that our surface inherits from being part of the manifold? So that, well, what we do is we take our higher dimensional metric and we effectively just project out all the orthogonal directions. So as an exercise, I invite you to do that for the two-sphere. If you use polar coordinates, it's absolutely super simple, because in polar coordinates, you've already got the theta phi as part of your metric. And so all you're doing is subtracting off the radial part. So you can see that that just kills GRR, this relation. But you can also do it in the X, Y, and Z if you're fond of a treat, and see that it also gives, in terms of a 3x3 matrix, a degenerate metric. It has to be degenerate because it's a metric on a two-dimensional surface. But it will just be a coordinate transformation of the intrinsic metric. Mm-hmm.
In the picture of the foliation, are we assuming that our space-time has time translation symmetry?
Or in which?
In what you explain about ADM formalism, mm-hmm. about taking slices, are those, all the slices diffeomorphic, or are they
not necessarily? I mean, they do not assume time translation symmetry at all. The idea is that these surfaces are evolving. Yeah, so you might start off with a surface that is, you know, sort of roughly flat, for example, but has a little bit of matter on it. But then as you move forward, that matter might cluster together and then form a black hole. So that's an example where you start with a regular surface and you evolve forward into something that actually develops trapped surfaces, and then, you know, which sort of is an indicator there's a horizon, and then develops a singularity.
Can the matter be like all over the space-time, or we assume that asymptotically we are flat?
I don't think you need to. ADM is really just about splitting. It's 3+1 sometimes it'll be called as well. So, I mean, actually, when you do cosmology, you're kind of usually picking a time and you're looking at your spatial sections, and then you're often sort of evolving perturbations. So, yeah, I mean, that was just meant to be a sketch, you know, sort of for the concept rather than being taken literally, yeah.
When you've got the ADM formalism and you reach, like, the horizon of a black hole where, you know, time and space kind of flip, how does it handle that with, like, does it break down there? Does it?
So, I'm thinking of it now in terms of slices across the Penrose diagram. It would only break down, I guess, when you hit the singularity. However, I'm not sure what it means if you're in practice, you know, a card-carrying numerical relativist. I'm not quite sure what happens in terms of your code, because I don't do that. But, you know, typically, I mean, they're looking usually for trapped surfaces, which is where every single future pointing light ray is kind of converging inwards. So at that level, I'm not sure. Okay, you'd have to ask someone who actually does that. But just thinking about it from the perspective of what would the Penrose diagram look like for a collapsing surface, then I would, you know, I can still draw my space-like surfaces all the way up to the singularity. But that's, you know, just because you can do something, you know, in theory, doesn't mean that that's how it works when you're actually calculating in practice. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. In the definition of induced metric that you mentioned over there, you said one star fundamental form. Is it like Hajdul of like a function?
No. So you're asking about the word use of the word form.
Yeah. ST, I thought it's a star, and I was wondering, because, you know, once...
Yeah, it's not a form in that sense. It's just that when you look at the literature on this, we would tend to say induced metric, right? Because that's sort of plain English. But I guess, you know, when the mathematicians were developing it, they called it the first fundamental form. So I'm just saying that's the mathematical nomenclature. But it is not a form because it's symmetric. It's, you know, it inherits the symmetry from the metric, and you can see that obviously the ends are symmetric. Yeah. So I agree. It's an interesting use of the word form. oh my goodness. So it's H. Notice here, this thing lives in H itself lives in the cotangent space of the manifold, right? But we can also ask what happens to the intrinsic definition, because we have that picture of sigma just as existing in and of itself. And in essence, what we do is we say, just like you're using the higher dimensional metric to deduce what a metric is on the submanifold, here you're actually projecting down. So here, this object here, dx nu by d sigma b, so it projects you from the cotangent space of M into the cotangent space of sigma. So this is where, if I'm using, just to spell it out, it's sort of implicitly, you know, A, B, these are intrinsic indices. And either A, B, or mu nu are the M indices. extrinsic indices. So that just says, we haven't really done anything much yet. We've just been rather clear about how we think about, you know, which tangent space we're in, whether it's the manifold or the submanifold. And also we're saying that the submanifold inherits its distance function from the higher manifold. And that's exactly what happens with the two sphere. Now we're going to start thinking about curvature. Okay, sorry, that was a lot of writing. So let me talk over it. All right, so the second fundamental form, so this is again paralleling the first fundamental form, but we call it the extrinsic curvature, and it's defined really as the way that the normal is changing as you move around the surface projected onto the surface. So if I sketch a sort of very curved surface here. If I draw a normal of that surface, you can see that at times that normal is changing direction. So here I'm thinking of this line as a submanifold, a one-dimensional submanifold of R squared, the plane. So here we're dealing with R squared, and this is some x of t, for example. So this is one dimensional, this is our sigma. And I sketch the normal, so I'm literally just drawing a normal from that curve. And you can see that as I move, the normal's swaying back and forth. So if I ask what is the, you know, the covariant derivative is telling you about parallel transport and what's the difference. So if I parallel transport that n here, it's going in that direction. Okay, so that tells me that grad n doesn't vanish. And then if I look at it infinitesimally, so this is like delta n, then that is projecting this difference in n down onto the curve is what's giving me the extrinsic curvature. So in that case, I see that the normal is swaying back and forth, so I know I've got some curvature as a result of the way the manifold is embedded.
Sorry, is the parallel transport here, are we doing that in the, are we doing that in like the higher manifold, or are we doing?
Well, in this case, the blackboard is the manifold, which is flat R squared. This is my submanifold, which I've just snaked, drawn something freehand. And so this defines my submanifold. It's one dimensional submanifold of the blackboard. I just draw my normals in, and then I notice that the normals are swaying. And so if I look at what this definition, where is it here? Yep. Well, if I look at what this definition says, it says take the covariant derivative. I know that's not zero because my normal is moving. And I just project it down onto the surface, and that's my extrinsic curvature. So in this case, you know, k, it's so low dimensional, k would just be a number. But k becomes non-zero every time that line starts to bend. And in fact, the only place it isn't really bending is somewhere around about here. Okay?
We symmetrize the covariant derivative.
Yeah.
Just a parallel transport thing.
Actually, I shouldn't have done. I'm sorry, this is the wrong index, isn't it? Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. You see it actually here. You take the covariant derivative, but then you're kind of just projecting it right down. And the reason I put this last line in is because in practice, when you're computing extrinsic curvatures, sometimes it's easier to use the top line because, let's say, what's happening, the components that you're looking at are sort of they're spectators. So, for example, if you had a spherically symmetric bubble moving in a spherically symmetric background like Schwarzschild, your theta and phi are sort of just spectators to this surface. And so it's easier to use the top line, whereas if you wanted to look at the normal of of what the trajectory was, it's actually easier to use the second one. So another definition, which wouldn't be triggered by that one. Example. Now, if you have more than one codimension, you can imagine, for example, now if I translate that curve into R cubed, I can imagine having normals that just to be perverse, I've got two normals, and as I move along my curve, I could imagine twisting them. And that wouldn't be changing the geometry of my submanifold at all. So that would be just making my life difficult. And this is sort of encapsulated by this normal fundamental form. It's saying that n can change not just parallel to your surface, but also normal to the surface. But as you can imagine, that is probably not a physical quantity. So, yeah, question.
I was wondering why we symmetrize the h's?
It's because and I suppose I could sort of say it's the definition, right? But it's really where, we're kind of interested in what's happening in terms of the change of n. I'm guessing maybe it's because if there is a sort of anti-symmetric piece to that, it's probably something that's more gauge. You know, it's not actually relevant. I'm just saying that because that's the definition, right?
This one's symmetrized, but that one's not.
Yeah, so that was, I don't know, yeah, so let's just say that.
Okay.
Might just play around with it. I'm not sure if there is actually, there's obviously, potential for anti-symmetry in DN, right? But I'm not sure whether, I'd have to sit down with a piece of paper and see what, follow it through. I don't have a good response to that one off the cuff. So again, I think, you know, examples are quite useful to see this, how it sort of works. So the obvious example, because mathematicians tell you a cylinder is flat, and I think people sometimes have a hard time with that when they first hear that. So let's look at why that is hard to get wrap your head around. So our normal here is cos theta sine theta 0. That's the normal to the surface. It's just pointing radially outwards in the xy plane. So my HAB, which is just delta AB, in this case minus NA and B because of the signature of the Euclidean metric, so that's, I think I said, you know, I invited you to do the two sphere. This is what you get if you just keep in the standard coordinates that make your higher dimensional manifold look easy. But if I go to cylindrical polars, then I get something that's a lot better looking. So this makes it clear that you have, you know, this degeneracy, that this really is something acting on a lower dimensional space. So in this case, my K is just the connection components in polars. If I stick with polars. So this is in my tangent, sort of looking at these objects as being in the tangent space of M. But intrinsically, sorry. So I find that my cylinder has extrinsic curvature, okay? So we're going to see why it doesn't have actual curvature in a moment, but this is why we intuitively think of the cylinder as curved. It's because it is curved as an embedding in R cubed. So to our eye, it has curvature.
Mm-hmm. You say it's the connection?
Yeah, we inherit the connection on sigma by just projecting everything down. It's basically the higher dimensional connection, but where you've only taken the bits that live in the sigma tangent. So you're not introducing a new connection when you look at sigma. It's just inheriting the connection from the manifold. And then just quickly another example to show the normal fundamental form. Let's just look at a helix. So the helix is something that's going round in a circle around the z-axis, but as it goes round, it's also moving up. So that's our manifold or our submanifold. It's one dimensional, so it has two normals. In order to find the normals, we look back at what that top board there. We look back at how we see the normals. Well, the normals are something that are orthogonal to the tangent vectors of the submanifold. So I need the tangent vector of the submanifold. That's my tangent vector. Not normalized. So N1, I could take cos t sine t 0, and my N2 minus sine t cos t minus 1. So I just picked two obvious ways of dotting with that x, that tangent vector x dot, to give me 0. So one of them is just pointing outwards, always in the xy plane. And then the other one is saying it's kind of tangent in terms of the theta direction, but it picks a normal in the z direction. So my N1 in cylindrical polars So I'm just using rho as the radial distance in the xy plane rather than r. Just, well, I used r up there, did I, or not? And N2 is 1 over rho d by d theta minus d by dz. So if I want to look at the normal fundamental form, so that is I've only got one normal fundamental form because I've only got two normals. So I've just got a beta 1, 2. So here, this has just got an R component or rho component in cylindrical polars. Sorry, I shouldn't use the eyes. Let me just, so sorry about that. So here, if I just look at the part of this covariant derivative that's the partial derivative, I don't get anything because the N2 only has non-zero components in theta and z, and the N1 is just in rho. So I've only got the gamma, the connection term of this, which is just the standard connection in cylindrical polars. So the only component here that contributes is theta. So that puts that to theta, which means this has to be theta for that to be non-zero. So that means this is delta A theta, and it is that connection term, sorry, is minus rho, gamma rho theta is minus rho, and then N2 theta is 1 over rho. So that tells me that I only get one non-zero component of beta, which is just minus 1. So it's saying that beta is just d theta in that case. So I chose my normals just by kind of looking and seeing what looked easy, but it gives me a non-zero normal connection. Lost my place now. Okay, so that's some examples. Okay, let me put that up so you can see it. Okay, so having got to the point of deciding what the metric induced on the surface is and talking about the extrinsic curvature, which, given that it's talking about how the normal changes, you see that that's kind of taking some components of the connection, sort of, you know, encoding the information. Some components of the connection. But that then gives us enough information to then say, what is the curvature on sigma? And so this is called the Gauss equation, and it tells you that to get the curvature on the surface, you first of all take the curvature of the manifold and project everything down into the surface. So that's essentially saying that you're taking the parallel curvature that sigma inherits because the higher dimensional manifold is curved. But then you also have some curvature coming from the embedding. So that's the second piece. And sort of intuitively, you can kind of see this looks like it's coming from the gamma wedge gamma piece. So if you think about the sphere, the sphere is embedded in flat space, so there is no Riemann curvature of the manifold. So that first line is zero. However, the sphere has two components, or many, of the extrinsic curvature. It's curving not just along the theta direction, but also along the phi direction. And so the KK terms will not vanish. However, for the helix, not the helix, the cylinder, the extrinsic curvature has only one term. And so when you anti-symmetrize on the C and D, I mean, you know, in that case, that will kill that one non-zero component. So that the cylinder, as an embedding in R cubed, is flat. But it has extrinsic curvature. And so that's why it seems like a sort of confusing statement when mathematicians first tell you the cylinder is flat. It's because we see the extrinsic curvature, but that doesn't mean that it's intrinsically curved. So this is kind of separating intrinsic and extrinsic contributions.
So I just wanted to ask really quickly, is this, if you were to calculate the Riemann curvature tensor of sigma, not like if it was not an embedding, would you get the same answer?
Well, if you mean, so if you're asking, let's pretend I never knew about M, right? But someone gave me gamma. Yeah. And then I calculated Riemann from gamma. It's the same thing. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So this is just like a trick that, you know, you can calculate it in terms of the, you know, higher manifold.
Yeah, I think that what this is doing is it's delineating what parts of the curvature of sigma come from the fact that your manifold is curved and what parts come from the embedding itself. So I'm not sure I have time to keep going on this. So I think I'm going to more or less stop here, but let me just sort of give you a bit of a sort of pointer as to where these concepts come in. So for example, if you look at this relation here and look at that extrinsic curvature, if you take the trace of that, that tells you that the intrinsic wave operator of X mu vanishes. Now that is a condition that tells you, sort of constrains your embedding. And so that is actually the equation of motion for a string whirl sheet, sort of in the absence of charge, right? So, you know, you see a lot of these equations or this formalism cropping up in maybe not in exactly the same language, but this sort of crops up when you do string theory. So that's kind of part of the reason, if you like, that I've called these internal coordinates sigma b, because it's like sigma and tau. And also, if you're thinking about dynamical objects in gravity, like domain walls or cosmic strings, again, your equations of motion tend to reduce to constraints on the embedding. So in other words, usually, that trace of the extrinsic curvature vanishes. So these, you know, this at the moment we've just done the mathematics of it, but in terms when we sort of look at what are the equations of motion for some of these embeddings, we can relate those to the energy momentum of those surfaces. So I want to pick up that thought next week, talking about these submanifolds as physical objects or brains. And also we'll go back and close the loop with the Euclidean action and talk about black hole thermodynamics.